So let's think about words for it, obviously, because Psalms in the Bible are made up of words, aren't they? It's easy to assume that if a word exists, that so must its opposite word. You know the sort of thing? So if maybe you on this side of the room are political, it's quite possible for those on the other side of the room all to be apolitical, isn't it? Especially with Greek words, the little word, the prefix a in front of it means the opposite, doesn't it? And so if, say, being a Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, Gnostic, means knowing something, often knowing about God or that there is a God, of course, then being agnostic, means the opposite, doesn't it? Not knowing. Yeah? So we could play a little game, but I think probably mainly old enough that we don't need to do that. Another example, if having a temperature is symptomatic of having COVID, for example, then being asymptomatic means not having any symptoms of COVID and other things as well. Or if something is dimorphous, where di means two, morphous means shape, and it comes in two shapes, then something amorphous must be what? Shapeless, yes, or no shape. That's right, I think we're getting the idea. Or another one, right, if living a moral life is possible, then living an amoral life must be possible, mustn't it? Well, not so sure about that, because I think actually an amoral life, a life without morals, would actually turn out to be an immoral life, wouldn't it? So it doesn't necessarily follow that just because of the word and an opposite, that it's possible to have one of those in reality, you see. And so we arrive at the word theist. Everybody knows what a theist is? Anybody not know what a theist is? A theist is someone who believes in God, or at least believes that there is a God. And so you'd think, if you can have a theist, maybe we're all theists here, or we wouldn't be here this evening, perhaps. I don't know. We might have been dragged along to hear what this guy has to say about Psalm 14, because it talks about atheists, seemingly. But if it's possible for there to be a theist, then it must also be possible to be an atheist, mustn't it? Ah, well, that's the rub. That's the right word, certainly. Is it possible? And the answer would seem to be basically no, according to Psalm 14. And no, according to the first verse of Psalm 14. And you can see also no, according to the heading on your handout, the first heading on your handout. I'll try and put back there. Yes, have a look at the first line of the first verse of Psalm 14. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Now that might at first sight look as if it's talking about an atheist who is a fool, mightn't it? It's using a rude word to describe someone who doesn't believe in God, maybe. But in reality, you know, atheism is not an honest mistake. Atheism, trying not to believe in God, is not just a sincerely held belief. It's more like a sort of process that starts with rejecting God and ends with being able to sin and do evil things easily, deliberately, and habitually. And that seems to be what's being spoken of in this psalm, where the fool says in his heart, there is no God. If it had been written in English, it probably would have said something like, the fool tells himself there is no God. He's almost as if he's trying to convince himself there is no God, you see. That's the kind of meaning. So let's think of an example. 1 Samuel chapter 25. You probably had some sermons on this not that long ago, didn't you? 1 Samuel 25 tells the story of a man called Nabal. Remember that name. He was described as harsh and badly behaved in the English Standard Version, or surly and mean in the New International Version. He opposed King David, God's anointed king. And in verse 38 of the chapter, God strikes him dead. And then we remember why we've been told the name of this villain. The name Nabal means fool, because in rejecting God's anointed king, he was really rejecting God. He was behaving as if there were no God. He was an attempted atheist, and the word, the phrase attempted atheist is my lame attempt to substitute something that is true for the word atheist that isn't really true of anyone at all. The fool tells himself there is no God. And in fact, the Apostle Paul in Romans explains how there's no real thing as an atheist, no such thing as an atheist as well. We read earlier in Romans chapter 1, verse 18. You might just like to flip back there. You didn't keep a finger in Romans 1, verse 18. Just a couple of verses are worth, well, no, the whole of Romans looking at. I'm just waiting for you to find it, if you wish. Romans 1:18, Paul writes, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." Right? There's a definite process that is going on. An effort is being made to get rid of the truth. "For what can be known about God is plain to them." It's obvious to some degree, right? "Because God has shown it to them." And then later on, towards the end of verse 20, "so they are without excuse." So in those verses, you see, the Apostle Paul is saying that the attempted atheist has suppressed the truth about God. And it's interesting that he doesn't use the word atheist, because I don't think Paul believes in atheists either, you see. So the attempted atheist is not someone who's just mistaken. It's not just a nice and sincerely held view. Point, sort of Radio 4 BBC type viewpoint, where you hear it a lot, of course, or even on the side of the bus. You can see that picture on your handouts there. That's Richard Dawkins and the Humanist Society's take on it. There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Which raises the question, why do people tell themselves there is no God? And it's sort of on that bus poster, "there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." What do they mean by that? Well, really, and in reality, people tell themselves that there is no God, like the first line in the psalm, "the fool says in his heart, there is no God." Why? Because they want to do lines 2 and 3 in the psalm. Can you see them? They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. In other words, they want to do corrupt things. They want to do abominable deeds. And where it says there is no one who does good, well, obviously they want to do things that are not good. In other words, sinning and really enjoying it is really difficult if you think that God is looking over your shoulder or even directly at you, isn't it? Furthermore, the attempted atheist imagines that if somehow he is wrong, if he's mistaken, and where Richard Dawkins wrote, "there's probably no God," and Dawkins was wrong and he kind of knew it, so he used the word probably, and actually one day we will all stand before God's judgment throne, then the want-to-be atheist, the attempted atheist, has a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card, he thinks. He thinks, he imagines that if somehow he's wrong and has to stand before God, he will be able to say, "oh, well, I was an atheist, you see. So if I'd only realized that you existed, God, I might have done what you said," and think that God will let him off. And it really isn't like that, because atheism is not just a sincerely held belief. It's not just a well-meaning mistake. It is the process of rejecting God. And so we must remember that some of our friends actually think just like that. You know, with the help of Richard Dawkins, Radio 4, BBC and all that, this is how people think. They really do think like that. And if we love them, if we care for them, then we will want to challenge, severely challenge their attempted atheism. You will not want to leave your friends and neighbours and families thinking those kinds of thoughts. And so we will read books of a helpful kind. We will go to Libri lectures if that's helpful. We will discuss with other Christians how to undermine our friends and neighbours and families' attempted atheism by how we live, yes, but by what we can say to help as well. Because you don't want their only defence to be on the day of judgment, "oh, I was an atheist, you see." So that's the attempted atheist. We move on now to verses 2 and 3. The practical atheist. And I borrowed that phrase from B.B. Warfield. I'll tell you more about him later. Because now something scary happens as we continue reading Psalm 14, as if it wasn't scary enough in verse 1 somehow. Verse 2, the Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, any who seek after God. Well, you think, God has really got the measure of those supposed atheists, hasn't he? And, well, no, it isn't like that, actually. Look again at verse 2. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man. That means all of us humans. It says all mankind if you're looking at an NIV. Children of man means all of us humans. But then we kind of resist and we think, but he still doesn't mean all of us are like this, does he? The Lord looks down from heaven on all of us to see if any of us understand, any of us seek God. Doesn't really mean all of us, does he? But he does, you know. He means all of us. Look at verse 3. What does God see when he peers down from heaven, as Dale Ralph Davies puts it? Verse 3. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good. And just in case there's any shadow of doubt, he ends the verse, not even one. And if there's still a shadow of a shadow of doubt, then you perhaps remember that the Apostle Paul refers to this very psalm in Romans chapter 3, in verses 9 to 12. He says something, then quotes verses 2 and 3 of the psalm, you see. In verse 9 of Romans 3, he says, what then? Are we any better off, meaning the Jewish people? No, not at all, for we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, in other words, everybody, are under sin. As it is written, and then he quotes verses 2 and 3 of the psalm to show that actually even we who are God's people behave like practical atheists, at least some of the time. So we do believe in God, but we don't always behave as if we believe in God. We don't always behave like theists. That means we practically sometimes behave like atheists. So this is ironic, isn't it? Got some examples. Think of these examples. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe you fancy getting on your own and reading or looking at something inappropriate, shall we say, on the internet, on your computer or on your device, your phone or something like that. So what do I do if I want to do that? Well, I carefully ignore what the Lord Jesus said about lust. I quietly what the Apostle Paul wrote about immorality in God's Word, the Bible. What am I doing when I do that? Well, I'm sort of enabling myself to read or look at something inappropriate on the internet whilst not feeling too bad about it by sidelining God. In other words, I'm rejecting God, aren't I? I'm being practical atheist at that point in my behaviour. I don't believe that, really, but I'm behaving as if I do. Or what about if you fancy writing a really snotty review on Airbnb or eBay or Amazon or whatever your preferred platform is? So I carefully forget what God has said about it being his role to avenge and not mine in Romans 12. And I write the snotty review and I feel good for a little while. What have I done there? Well, I've enabled myself to sin by sidelining God, by behaving as a practical atheist. Not totally, not all the time, but then and there. That's what I've done, isn't it? Or maybe I feel very worried about something. You know, the kind of worry that really gnaws in your stomach and makes you feel ill. And then, thanks to a service or a prayer or a reading or another Christian, or Romans chapter 8, verse 28 comes to mind. All things work together for good to those who love God. What do I do? Do I take hold of the verse with both hands? Or do I say, no, I want to sort of engage in my worry. It somehow feels better, almost happier to have a good gnawing worry about whatever it is. What am I doing in that situation? Well, in sidelining the promise in God's word, really I'm being a practical atheist again, aren't I? Fiddling a tax return is much easier to do if you just manage not to think about your God's omniscience or holiness for a few hours, isn't it? And in the situation, this is a subtle one, okay? If your conscience tells you that something's wrong, but then you also tell yourself, well, I'll do it anyway because God will forgive me. That's his job. Catherine the Great said, God will forgive me. That's his job. C'est son métier. It's his job. A subtle reframing, sort of, so we change the God that we believe in to a God who it's his job to forgive us and nothing else. That's a more subtle form of practical atheism, isn't it? And yet, our hearts are desperately wicked and beyond knowing, Jeremiah tells us. That's the kind of trick we play on ourselves, isn't it? So if we know that we too can be practical atheists, that should humble us, for starters, I trust. It should also make us more approachable and able to help those who'd like to be atheists. And it should make us sympathetic towards those who are not Christians. And hopefully we can be on guard against the intrigues of our own deceptive hearts, because although they're my examples, I trust you can see that actually your heart does something similar to all the things that I was able to invent out of my own evil heart in those examples. So that's the practical atheist then. We've had the wannabe atheist, what did I call him exactly? I've forgotten the word. The attempted atheist. We've had the practical atheist. And yet, you know, when we read the rest of this psalm, this is the third heading on your handouts, it's obvious that there are two very clear, totally separate categories of people. And they are the traditional biblical categories of the wise and the foolish, the righteous and the unrighteous, you know. So verse 4 says, have they no knowledge? That's the foolish, isn't it? It's the non-Christian, in effect. All the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread, that's the non-Christian. And do not call upon the Lord, that's the non-Christian, isn't it? So we have the foolish who have no knowledge. They lack godly wisdom. They're in verse 4, don't we? We have evildoers, because that's what characterizes their lives, doing evil. We have those who do not call upon the Lord, the ones who are self-sufficient, who don't want to rely on God. And those are the unwise, the evil. And then we have the other category, the other broad category, the wise, who are referred to as my people in that verse. God's people. In other words, they're the ones who do call upon the Lord. You perhaps remember how in Genesis 4, after everything has gone wrong, and people start to seek after God, in Genesis 4, 26, men are said to start calling upon the Lord. So there are these two broad categories that don't actually mix, despite all that I've been saying about practical atheists and wannabe atheists, tempted atheists. And as the psalm goes on, perhaps we can see in verse 5 that that really describes our own situation, maybe, in this country where persecution is mild, you have to admit, on the whole, most of the time. Not always, but for most people. There they are. That's the foolish, or the evil. There they are in great terror. For God is with the generation of the righteous. So the fool or the evil there actually feels threatened by the Christian. You've perhaps been in a situation yourselves where your quiet confidence is a bit scary, and so they ostracize you or you, but the persecution doesn't tend to be too bad in this country, does it? And then in verse 4, did you notice the scary line where it says, all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread? Well, that would seem to be talking about the Christians in terrible countries where the persecution is unimaginably bad, really. Like in North Korea, where people are persecuted terribly, even when a family member becomes a Christian or something like that. Or the situation in China. Did you know the under 18s are not even allowed to go to church in China? Or Nigeria, where Boko Haram kidnaps, murders, rapes to show what a wonderful religion Islam is. That's all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread, isn't it? And the psalmist continues describing the foolish or the evil, the wannabe atheists in verse 6. You would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge, the refuge of the poor. In other words, they rubbish what we do. They humiliate the poor or frustrate the plans of the poor, is how the NIV puts it. And this psalm was written in about 1000 BC by King David. He's the author of the psalm. And the author's problems were the ungodly in Israel around him and the Philistines around them. And so he cries out in verse 7, oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. What's that? Well, it's a prayer, isn't it? Of the wise to be rescued from the foolish, of the righteous to be rescued by God from the evil. And God heard David's prayer. Less than a generation later, the Philistines were entirely dealt with, and there was some measure of godliness in the nation of Israel. And in the same way, we must constantly pray, as the psalmist does in that first line of verse 7, oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. And we should pray for these atheistic regimes in China and North Korea and Afghanistan and Nigeria, that God would shorten the time of his people's suffering, that he would make them strong, that he would remember his people. Hebrews 13 says, remember those who are in prison, which probably means in our time, those who are in terribly persecuted countries, doesn't it? And in the same way that God saved his people through King David, so God and King Jesus will one day defeat all of his people's enemies, including yours and mine. But in the meantime, we must remember to pray and perhaps help and give money and all that sort of thing. Pray for our persecuted brothers and sisters, not just forget them and not neglect them. Hopefully, in conclusion, then, we have in our minds two clear categories of people. One is the wise, the righteous, the godly, the saved, God's people. Those are all biblical expressions or words to describe one kind of person. And then the other clear category of people in this psalm, and indeed in the rest of the Bible, of course, is the foolish, the wicked, the evil, the unsaved, God's enemies. There was a lady in our church in Liss who died recently called Gail, and she was quite fun to have at meetings. Some of us will know. I never understood many of the things she said, and I didn't understand some of the things she prayed about either in meetings. But suddenly she would become very lucid and very clear that there are these two categories of people, and there were her neighbours and her family and her friends who were in one category, and she prayed and she longed for God to transfer them to the other category. She was very, very clear about that. This old Gail, and she died just last month, I think it was, wasn't it? But in the case of the foolish category, because it's not just a category, is it? These are real people. In the case of the foolish, we must not allow them to justify their ungodly behaviour, must we? We must not allow them to pretend that there is no God. We must challenge their attempted atheism. It's so important that we do not allow them to be smugly continuing to think that there is any such thing as a real atheist. No, they're rejecting God, and we must challenge that. And that means doing our homework to make sure that we can challenge that. But we who claim to be wise, even though we know we're not always wise, we must make sure that we do not behave like practical atheists. Some of the time, we know we're not actually atheists, we're theists, but we understand, I hope, now having looked at this psalm, that it's quite possible for us sometimes to be practically atheists. We must so risk that, because we know that we only behave like practical atheists, pretending there is no God for a moment, so that we can sin with impunity, don't we? You look at your heart, you know that that's not really what you want to be like and what you want to do, don't you? But we do it sometimes, and that's when we're being practical atheists. And you might say, well, this is ridiculous. You've said that non-Christians are not really atheists, but Christians really are sometimes. And actually, if you've got that, that's a pretty good summary, I think. I mentioned B.B. Warfield earlier. There's his mugshot on the bottom of the handout. He was a 19th century, very early 20th century theologian in America. Wrote all sorts of stuff, some not so useful stuff. And he wrote this. He said, how many, he means Christians, okay, how many who would not even think of saying in their hearts, there is no God, deny him practically by ordering their lives as if he were not, as it means, as if he did not exist. Okay. How prone we are to feel God's presence and activity in some things, but not in others. We look for his guidance in some matters, but not in others. We can trust him in some crises, think plural of crisis, yeah, and with some of our hopes, but not others. This too is practical atheism, and maybe Warfield invented this phrase, practical atheism. How are we to order our lives? Is it true that we can trust the eternal welfare of our souls to God and cannot trust him with the temporal welfare of our bodies? Slightly old-fashioned language, I know. He's saying we can trust God for salvation, but not to look after us now and our bodies and our illnesses and things. Is it true that he has provided salvation for us at the tremendous cost of the death of his son and will not provide us food to eat and clothes to wear? Is it true that we can stand by the bedside of our dying friend and send him forth into eternity in good confidence to God and cannot send that same friend forth into the world with any confidence that God will keep him safe there? Another example will be, it's easy to trust God for ourselves, but it's so hard to trust him for our children. Have you noticed that? If not, when you grow up and you've got your own children, you might remember this. That was me, not Warfield. Warfield goes on, oh, the practical atheism of many of our earthly cares, by which he means our earthly worries. How many of us can risk ourselves that we do not think we can risk our families in God's keeping? How subtle the temptation. So in this way, this psalm really digs under our flesh, doesn't it? It gets under the skin. So look, let's make sure that we try to rescue some attempted atheists from our friends and neighbours and family, whilst at the same time making sure that we ourselves are not practical atheists some of the time in some areas of life. And then one day this world will be over, and when the Lord restores the fortunes of his people, let Jacob rejoice, let Israel be glad.